This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Highways to the north, south, and west are clogged with frantic human traffic.
So you're going to build eco-cities? Don't make me laugh. Just as green mayors finally arrive, the financial collapse is draining cities into poverty. San Francisco has almost $500 million in revenue shortfall. Vancouver is slashing, starting with a 40-year-old plant conservatory. The only stimulus left is for the banksters and dinosaur highway projects. It's time to call in Richard Register, one of the inventors of the ecological city concept. He knows the time is late, the climate is damaged, energy is declining along with the economy. Now Richard is going to take you on a lightning tour around the world with visions from even the poorest people with better ways to live. Maybe the big change will give us back living spaces to love. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In our second half hour, we'll explore the currents of microscopic toxins that swirl around the globe right into our homes and our bloodstreams. We'll go chasing molecules with investigative author Elizabeth Grossman. Then we'll get some expert tips on cutting your personal footprint up to 40%. That's the economical environmentalist Prashant Fazi from London. But first, from the Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, this is Oakland's Richard Register.
In the title of my talk is Time of Crisis, When the Visionary Becomes the Practical. You know, how do we actually live? How do we actually build our communities, and how do we live in those communities? And the visionary has to become practical pretty soon, or we're in real trouble. And we all know that. I think we all realize that with climate change and species extinction and so on, we're in a real crisis situation, and we need to come up with the best ideas about the overall larger patterns that are shaping our lives. Well, a few nights ago, I was at a dinner that was sponsored by Climate Work. You may have heard of them. They fund a lot of research on climate change. And the guy that was sitting two seats from me has saved the world. I mean, this is not figurative. This is absolutely literal. I was sitting next to a guy that saved the world. Now, who would this guy actually be? His name is Mario Molino, and he's the person who discovered something was perilously wrong with the CFCs in the atmosphere, that you couldn't just spray your hair and your paint and run refrigeration units without some kind of a cost in the upper stratosphere. We had a real problem there. And back around 1973, when he was looking at these figures, like in this movie, how many of you have seen When Worlds Collide in 1951? A scientist sees, an astronomer sees a planet coming towards the Earth, and he says to himself, oh my God, if my figures are correct, we're all doomed. What can we do about it? That much of the material going up into the sky and that kind of an effect on the stratosphere in relation to letting the UV through, the ultraviolet waves, it could destroy the entire biosphere. Well, he got very active. He put the best science together he could. He looked at the larger patterns. He and his research partners got motivated and really worked hard. They went to hearings. They did public talks. They did their science as well as they could, and they really solved the problem, that problem. So I asked him, well, now what do we do about climate change? So this is the main part of what I want to talk about, the actual physical arrangements of a city that I think would be ecologically healthy. But I'll start with climate change. This is the upper reaches of the Yangtze River, where the glaciers are melting very rapidly. But it's caused by something more than anything else that the scientists at the climate change conferences of the UN aren't even talking about. You don't hear them talking about the arrangement of the city, urban design. It's not one of the things they're dealing with. But it is the largest thing human beings build, and it's the largest cause, so I want to talk about that. We live in something that is largely sprawl development. This is Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we're swamped in automobiles around the entire world, even places that you don't associate generally with automobiles, like Paris. We build parking lots that go up into the sky, 22 stories in this German city here. 50 miles of processing for oil into gasoline in Texas. This facility goes 50 miles across the landscape to the Gulf of Mexico. And then we're actually living in that, and we're causing problems like the drying of the Ural Sea. And here you can see a boat that's been left behind. Well, one of the interesting things is what I call the rust factor, too. We're going to have to have absolutely assiduous recycling if we want to have materials to build our society with into the deep future. Iron is plentiful, but it actually rusts. To actually get the ore in high enough concentrations to be economically viable, that we can bring it into our society, we have to expend energy. So there's an energy and materials formula going on here that says we have to be extraordinarily careful about what we're building and recycle absolutely assiduously, or we're going to lose the metals, especially the rare metals that are turning up now in all our high technology equipment that we think is very essential. Well, let's get down to the basics of the biggest. This is the beginning of what you might actually think of as an eco-city or an ecological city, a little town called Kunra, and it's located in Turkey. On ground level, you see bicycles for getting around, and most of the motorized vehicles are actually vehicles for business. Up above ground level, where the shops are, you have the living quarters for most of the people, and on the rooftops, you see solar collectors getting the heat from the sun instead of from firing up your natural gas or other energy sources from fossil fuels. So this is the beginning of the idea of an ecological city. There are a lot of these places around, but we have to think about that as we go about designing our cities. On the larger scale, Curitiba, Brazil is very well laid out. Back around 1972, they decided that in the expansion of the city, they would use the transit system to pull the density together so people would be living close to the transit system, close to one another, and that gave them the opportunity to have open space very close into the city itself. So five long arms of high density reach out from a very pedestrian core in Curitiba, and nothing but buses and emergency vehicles are allowed on those streets, which are called dedicated routes for the buses. And the mayor at the time, Jaime Lerner, actually invented this transportation system here where the bus comes in, and he invited the bus company, Volvo, to set up a factory in Curitiba, which they did, and designed a bus according to his specifications. And people can go out three abreast and in and out of the bus, and they've paid their fee at the turnstile. And so the result is that it's 85% as efficient as a subway system. And they claim it cost them only 1/300 because they didn't have to dig down into the earth and create all these extra systems that work with subways. And because they did that, here in Curitiba, they had an enormous amount of open space. They had reforestation projects and large parks for people and so on. Well, my organization, which is called EcoCity Builders, got started quite some time ago. One of the things we did way back in 1979 was celebrate the 80th anniversary of the first automobile fatality. And a long time ago, I thought I was going to become a sculptor, and I met a fellow named Paolo Soleri. In 1979, we unveiled this vegetable garden, and some people would say things like, gee, what if that happened to all our cars? And I thought, well, that's something to think about. But one thing is depaving. So we've done some depaving projects. If the world is made up largely of cars and paving and low-density development and fossil fuel industry, supply systems, and this is one way to approach the problem. Low-income housing project in Berkeley, changing the parking lot into a garden. And then on a slightly larger scale, we've brought back some creeks that have been buried underground, used $25,000 to get this project started from the state of California, rented a bulldozer, brought out about 375 volunteers in the course of, you know, working on weekends in small groups to create a canyon. Then we let the water flow back into the canyon, crushed the old culvert. A building was built on top of that next door. You can simply drive these posts into the ground. These are short pieces of willow. And within about 3 months, you get a willow that's sending roots out to stabilize the creek bed and also to start growing. And within about 5 years, that's what it looked like at that exact location. The creek critters come back. The kids now have nature in their world. They can see insects like this. This is one of the most macho insects you're ever going to find in the world. He's the top of his food chain, a dragonfly, that you can get so close to, you can't focus on it anymore. He's completely secure in his world. So the kids get that kind of an opportunity when you bring nature back into the city. And more cities are going for this. San Luis Obispo, This used to be filled with blackberry bushes and old shopping carts and tricycles and refrigerators, and now it's a creek in a city. And the largest project I know like that is where this highway used to be in the middle of Seoul, Korea. And now this is what it looks like. It's an artificial waterway partially, but it's in the bed of a creek and it runs with the creek's natural flow when it's the rainy season, but the water has to be pumped in the dry season. But the people love it. And it brings a little bit of nature and the function of water and the celebration of nature into the city. And though they look a little ratty in this picture, all those bushes in the background are labeled because they're natives and so on. And people can learn a little bit about nature in their city. Then there's powering it, powering the city, the eco-city of the future, and windmills. This is from for electricity, a picture in Spain. The wind actually can drive this recreational vehicle from the salt flats of Australia, the picture from the 1800s. And whole ships now, like the Windstar, which I photographed here just 3 weeks ago in Istanbul, traveling around the world, gets 60% of its energy from the wind. And it only has to burn fossil fuels as it does part of the time because it has to keep a tight schedule and so on for the tourists. Then you can design buildings that bring shade into the building in hot climates. This is Ken Yang's work, an architect from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And you can also shade whole streets at the same with an umbrella like this in Singapore. So that's using shade and breezes. An artificial cloud, essentially, in Sinchin, China, by the architect Michael Chimchula. Very expensive to build something like that, but once built, all the buildings underneath it, which is a conference center and a city hall, run on much, much less energy in that hot climate because they're in the shadow of this enormous roof that's the size of 12 football fields. You can just imagine hanging cloth over streets just to keep the streets cool. Very simple, and marketplaces all over the world use it. And when I was in Istanbul a few weeks ago, this is what I saw. It's exactly what they're doing. Makes a very pleasant environment and keeps people very cool in these narrow streets. And say you're in a snowy climate, though this isn't that snowy. This is Milan, a very famous Galleria in Milan. But if it were a snowy climate or a colder area like Montreal, where they might be hosting our ninth International Eco-City Conference, you might want to reinforce that roof for the occasions when there's snow on it. But these sheltered streets are kind of fantastic. And this one has an edible creating the shade, which is a grapevine, once again in Istanbul. So you not only get the shade and the ambiance of a place like that and the freshening of the air, but you can actually get food. And one of the most interesting streets I know of, an interior street, and you can imagine these going through the middle of blocks, in a more dense city, is the Grand Bazaar of Istanbul. This is a pedestrian street in a totally car-free city called Bhaktapur. It's a medieval city in Nepal. And then you can work with the sun to collect energy. This is the work of Joachim Eble in a higher density place where you have these very small solar greenhouses essentially going up the side of an apartment building. So you can gather quite a bit of the sun in the high-density infrastructure. Or as in Tel Aviv, you can see the city practically glistens as if it had silver fish scales in the sun with solar hot water heaters. And I was there a few months ago also, and this is the research station for developing thermal solar energy in the middle of the desert, the Negev Desert near Tel Aviv. And that's me underneath this water boiler that's at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit with 1,600 mirrors shining up there. Very impressive delivery of energy to apartment houses and cities and so on. And then there's rooftop gardens. They're becoming fairly popular. I don't really need to talk about them too much. And then the rooftop gardens of Vienna by Hundertwasser. And notice what happens when the seasons change because you've clad your buildings in living material. The actual trees changing from season to season looks rather like that. It's kind of an amazing change to have happening on your buildings in a large scale. And in Venice, you have a whole city held together by bridges, another one of the elements of the future eco-city. A man walking from a residential district in San Francisco to the business district, and in the distance you see bridges between towers in a downtown hotel. And then bridges for animals in Australia so that the animals can cross over the highways without getting killed. And here's one of my favorite. This is a tunnel so the salamanders can get under a highway without getting squashed in their migrations. And then for transportation, a lot of the traditional things like streetcars work just fine. Go for that. In Istanbul, again, you have a larger multiple streetcar chain essentially here. And then, of course, high-speed rail, as I was in a few months ago in China. And you look onto the inside of that, you're hurtling along at 150 miles an hour. And if you have a glass of water on a table, and some of those cars have tables in them, the glass doesn't even shimmer. You can't see ripples on the water, 150 miles an hour. We should be able to do that in the United States, where I come from, but we're not. Then here's a bicycle shop in Ningbo, China. Bicycles are magnificently efficient. I mean, they run on a flat surface at 1/8 the energy that you put into walking. And what about the better car? My thesis is the better car makes a worse city. Because if you continue the habit of driving around in a better car and you feel good about your better car, you're still paving the world. So you have to go from the automobile to the bicycle, foot traffic, and design for what I call access by proximity. You can get access by traveling there, or you can get access by designing things so things are closer together. It's a pretty simple formula. So I don't think that's the answer. The car-free city is much more the answer. Car-free cities exist. I mentioned Bhaktapur and showed you a picture of it. Venice, Italy is a car-free city. But what about the eco-home? Here we have the Atlantis ecological house concept with a rooftop garden, and you have a car on permeable paving, and you collect the water in a cistern, and it's pretty good, as those kind of houses go. And here are here's the family that's there. There's three people. But then you go to the apartment house I live in, Oakland, California, and I've visualized here a party for the 39 of us that live in the building on three times the amount of land, do the math. This property is serving 19 times more people, or 13 times, excuse me, more people per acre. And not only that, we don't have to get in a car to go do whatever we want to do. We have the cafes, the banks, the copy shops, the hardware stores and everything within three or four blocks. And we can even rent a car for occasions at a car rental place that's in downtown Oakland, only four blocks away. And it gets solar energy for hot water. And then you look at the suburban situation, an area where you need to clear snow, like Montreal. And here you see on this block, the snow removal device is working for maybe two dozen, three dozen people. And here it's working for maybe 300 or 400 people in the same path that the vehicle takes. So you get the efficiencies of density that are really important. And here we have a picture of the location I actually live in, but 250 years ago, an illustration in a book called The Ohlone Way that's about the Native Americans who lived there in the San Francisco Bay Area, but this is what it actually looked like. Incredibly biodiverse. And I have this here as the beginning of a little discussion on mapping. You can imagine where you used to be and what kind of nature you could recover in some degree, not thoroughly, of course, but a lot, and you know, like bringing the creeks in and so on. And so here's the zoning map of Oakland, and everything you see in tones of yellow is only one or two stories high, and then you have the strips of a little more density and commercial. We're suggesting a more centers-oriented approach that looks at the city and sees that you can withdraw from sprawl development. You can bring back the creeks. You can augment the size of the community gardens and bring agriculture right into the city if you densify. European cities take up about 1/3 the land per capita of American cities, United States cities anyway. And that means that 2/3 of the cities of the United States are paved over with city that's yearning to breathe free. You know, you could actually roll back sprawl if you had a system for doing it. So this little mapping system begins to explore that concept. So here you're centers-oriented. You move towards the centers. You refine the map. You find that you can restore marshlands. You can restore the creeks. You can have your viable city centers, and they're all linked by transit and bicycle. And you find in China, that's exactly the way the traditional villages are laid out, as tiny little villages surrounded by nature in a pattern rather similar. Edaw, Garrett Ekpo mentioned earlier, was one of the founding members of, is a landscape architecture firm that actually ran with this concept recently in a competition in Los Angeles and said, okay, the water's coming up, let's withdraw a certain level. I think they were thinking about 25 feet as a worst-case scenario. Let's learn about the watersheds and what they're all about. And they came up with the same idea that we've been promoting in EcoCity Builders since the mid-80s, which is to find your centers, locate those centers, work with them, reinforce them. Then you can bring nature back in this process they did for Los Angeles. And then at nighttime, instead of a large swath of low density, a sheet of light, you get little spots of light looking down from a satellite, say. Here you have a structure that's going from the international style towers or slabs, mostly single use, to the idea of a very complex structure that rises up over its warehousing and so on, can be supplied by trains instead of trucks down highways, and becomes an environment of very high mixed use and very compact development with beautiful views and held together by bridges and so on. The idea was pioneered by a fellow named Paolo Soleri. He came up with a concept he called Arcology, Architecture and Ecology, and I met him back in 1965 when I was 21 years old and decided cities really did need really serious attention, that he was quite right. The two-dimensional city doesn't work. Everything about living organisms that are complex says they have to be three-dimensional. All living organisms of any complexity are three-dimensional, not flat like a sheet of paper. We should learn this in the way we're building cities. They have to be compact. So here's one that runs on solar energy in the wintertime, gets all its heat that way, and you can walk and bicycle everywhere. You could imagine a bicycle and pedestrian city that looks like this. Platforms that are filled with developers' apartments and condominiums and so on, and the whole thing's unified by these passageways and so on. Or you can imagine little fractions of this kind of thing with highly mixed use, and this is the work of Paul Downton in Adelaide, Australia. And the idea here is to have an urban fractal, the fraction of the whole that has all the essential components present, close enough together that you don't have to travel much. Another interesting Australian, by the way, by the name of David Ingwich, had a very interesting way of talking about cities. He says the city is an invention for maximizing exchange and minimizing travel. And that exchange goes all the way down to social exchange, economic exchange, exchange of DNA, meeting the person you will be living with and having children with and everything. And so if you can make that smaller, you have the possibility of a real ecologically healthy city. And he's managed to build part of that, not the whole thing. That's him on a rooftop garden, Paul Downton in Adelaide, Australia. But whole cities have been built like that, whole villages in the past. This is an eco-village that has moved into an abandoned small town in northern Italy called Torri Superiori. And then Paolo Soleri has been building Arcosani. This is what it looks like now. I've always suggested that since he's talking about three dimensions, you should make it a little bit more three-dimensional. So my own remodel of Arcosani, where I lived for a year once, would be to gather it together more like that. Maybe augment it with more three-dimensionality. I think these images stimulate some thoughts about reorganizing the way we build cities. And then it goes through seasonal changes, like here we're putting in the garden, and now it's summertime. And you can see over in the right-hand center there, essentially, is the power tower of Bright Source Energy out in the desert that most electricity comes from. And I think you've got quite a few of the images and good ideas of reorganizing space.
You just heard ecological city designer Richard Register with a report on the best green living innovations from around the world. The speech was recorded by Alex Smith at Radio EcoShock at the Gaining Ground Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada, October 20th, 2009. Download the full speech with introduction by Rob Abbott with a brief Q&A as a free MP3 file from our website at ecoshock.org. Look for the Cities page in our audio on demand menu. Track Richard Register at his blog, ecocityviews.blogspot.com, and check out ecocitybuilders.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.